Welcome to EI Talks, the podcast that takes ideas seriously. I'm Paul Lay, Senior Editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and I'm joined by Alistair Benn, Deputy Editor at EI. And we're delighted today to welcome Neil D. Lawrence to the studio, who is one of the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in the fields of AI, artificial intelligence, and machine learning. Neil is DeepMind Professor of Machine Learning at the University of Cambridge, and he's the author of a superb new book, The Atomic Human, Understanding Ourselves in the Age of AI, for which the phrase thought-provoking is hardly adequate. Welcome, Neil. Just so our listeners get a hang of things and where you're coming from, could you tell us something about your background? Because you're not only a theorist of AI and machine learning, but you've also been a practitioner in that world of AI and machine learning. So could you just give us a brief resume of your career so far?
Thanks for having me on, first of all. But yeah, absolutely. I guess I was always driven. My dad was an engineer, and I was always fascinated by creation and doing. And so I was a mechanical engineer as an undergraduate and always focused on what could I build. Loved Lego as a kid. You know, my dad had loved Meccano. I have his old Meccano set. So for me, I was always wanted to build. And I was very disappointed when I graduated university to see how poorly respected that was in the UK and the professions that were being offered to me, how badly paid they were, and how the UK engineering industry was sort of fading. This is like 1991. So I actually went into the oil rig because I just thought that would be exciting. So I went into oil rigs. But I kind of still wanted to solve problems. And I could see problems on the rig in terms of the processing we were doing with our tools. And that's what switched me on to this area of, at the time it was called neural networks, but machine learning. And so I went to do a PhD to do that. But I always thought at the end of the PhD, I would take these learnings and go back and immediately apply them. But again, when I graduated my PhD, no one was interested. I mean, it's incredible to think about it today. No one was interested in these interesting techniques. And I found in order to have a career, I had to do more to develop them and understand them and do more on the theory side. And I never thought of myself as someone who's strong on the theory side. But in order to deliver these solutions, that's what I had to do, work on the theories and the algorithms and explain to people how they were working and develop new algorithms to support people in their work. So for me, it was always about solving problems. But in order to do that, I had to take this long journey of becoming deeply steeped in the theory as well as the practice of how you solve those problems. Mm.
And can you tell us something about what are the aims of the book?
Yeah, in some sense, it's hard because the overall aim is so ridiculously ambitious. I don't think it can ever be fulfilled, which is to change the conversation and stop people saying ridiculous things about AI and bring regular people into the conversation, move it away. I think what we've got is a situation now where we're hearing from the wrong people. People who aren't deeply steeped in the technology, people whose understanding of society is limited, people who are only looking to capitalize on the technology, not to solve problems, but to make vast amounts of money. And I think that's unfortunately even affected organizations that should know better, including our government, in terms of who they're listening to. And this has been something that's particularly got worse over the last 2 years. So it's always been a difficult conversation to have because in some ways it's a complex topic, but in some ways it's a very simple topic. And people are being told that it's too complex for them to engage with. And the aim of the book, and I don't think any book can totally fulfill this, is to embrace people. And I'm not saying that it's all understandable by everyone because I'm limited in my capabilities to do that. But it tries various techniques to embrace people and empower people and allow them to realize, even if they don't have a technical background, even if they've not looked at these things before, that their voice is critically important in what we do with this technology because it's a transformative technology, not in the ways we're being told, not in the ways we're hearing in the public conversation, but it's still a transformative technology. And if we are going to transform into a world that we can all be proud of, we need as many voices as possible engaging in the debate about how that happens.
And can you give us a sense of what people get wrong about AI and what we should be getting right about it? What path should we be following? What path should we not?
Well, I think there's this tendency in the history of ideas, and there's a lot of history in the book, and that's primarily because you end up seeking solace in history, because what you're hearing now, I mean, in some ways it isn't solace, but it's also because you hear such ridiculous things. And I think the prime ridiculous argument we have is this sort of utopia, dystopia divide. The argument internationally is dominated by it's utopian or it's dystopian, like in these total extremes. And we can see that in the past. And this type of argument, at its worst, just leads to genocide. It genuinely does, in terms of, you know, you look at the sort of fascism, communism, this sort of like some simple idea of how society operates. Utopias are always associated with some simple idea of how society operates. But then, of course, there's the need to impose it on society. So as soon as you're talking about some sort of utopia where the AI decides all or something like this, and we're all living in this wonderful, I don't know, La La Land or something, that is also a dystopia. But then the counter side to that is if you're talking about the sort of dystopias where AIs take over and want to run the world for themselves, you're making a massive category error. You're sort of doing in effect what early religions, early civilizations did around their gods. They sort of just assumed that these gods, who they credited, of course, with vast powers, because that was their explanation for creation, when they thought about their behavior, they would just think, well, they would pretty much do what I would do in that case. So you get, you know, the way Zeus behaves is just the way a crazed male would behave, unregulated by society, trying to sleep with everything that moves and trying to hide it from his wife. These sort of bizarre things that is not what actually happens, because, of course, you know, these intelligences, to the extent that we should use the word intelligence, it's a difficult word, but they're just very different and outside the normal conception of the intelligence we're used to interacting with, which is other human intelligences. So a lot of what the book is trying to do is explain that difference and also bring in other intelligences, things like our immune system. And, you know, maybe it's a strong word here, but because it's a strong word here, you can see it's a strong word for AI. Our ecology is an information processing ecosystem. We don't tend to think of it as an intelligence. And the reason is because it operates so slowly, but it is an information propagation ecosystem that's responding to changes in its environment, making decisions, even if it's not making them in a sentient way, and trying to communicate these different forms of information processing to try and give people an idea of the thing you're interacting with you is nothing like you, is a sort of key part of the book. And it's a sort of category error. I've started thinking of it as like first order empathy, to sort of assume that whatever you're interacting with is, well, it's, we all do it, right? When we're conversing, we might assume that someone else is motivated in the same way we're motivated. That's like first order empathy. And it may work all right for humans. I think you learn as you get older that, no, they're motivated in different ways, or there could be different reasons for what they're doing. Not everyone's exactly like you. But it's totally a category error if you're doing it for a computer. And I think that's where this dystopia, utopia thing comes from, because what you're seeing is a reflection of what those individuals who talk about would do if they had what they perceive to be that, in inverted commas, power. And, you know, these are people who already are problematic on our planet in terms of having a large amounts of power and not being very aware of wider society and things that are outside their scope. So, of course, they think like that.
I love the kind of array of cultural references you draw on. I guess it's a way of your contention is that we tend to start with the human because we're locked in some way and move out towards machine intelligence and anthropomorphize it. But I love the way you use human stories to illuminate what is special about machine intelligence as well. You know, D-Day, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, Jean-Dominique Bobby's text when he was locked in, Prometheus and Epimetheus, Apollo 11. I'd just like you to talk about Bobby and why you use that story, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, which is a very famous film. I think it's good to keep talking about him because it's such a tribute to his powers of expression. It's like Beethoven composing things while he was deaf, you know, writing this book through blinking. What does that story tell us about machine intelligence?
Yeah, so Bobby was the French editor of Elle magazine, and in 1993 he had a brainstem stroke and was locked in. I haven't actually seen the film, but I read the book because one of the key points, so the notion of the atomic human is it's Democritus's atom. If you just keep cutting into our cognition in the way Democritus thought about cutting into a physical object, can you keep cutting as you get smaller and smaller? Do you always cut, or is there a place where you can't cut? So the notion of the atomic human is, where do you not cut? Or do you keep cutting? Does the machine take it all as it does things that we used to think of as formerly human? And one of the first thing I talk about in the book is, through Bowlby, is our limitations, and our limitations being our ability to communicate. So Bowlby was locked in. He ended up only being able to wink. And he wrote his book across, I think, 10 months, 4 hours a day, winking at letters. And I just think we're all sort of fascinated about that state. You know, probably many listeners have woken up in that state where you, for a moment, feel slightly paralyzed. Like, it's got a name, doesn't it? As you're emerging from sleep and you become conscious and you can't move your body. And it's very terrifying the moment it happens, isn't it? Because what you're looking at is becoming an entity which has all these sort of thoughts, but very little ability to communicate those thoughts. And we call that locked in. Mm. And of course, Bowlby wrote a book about what it felt like, because he wrote after he became locked in. But the point in that story is that that's the state we're all in. And not meaning that we're in exactly the same state as Bowlby, but we can measure information. I mean, there's another category error around intelligence that's often used, that we can measure it or rank it. It's ridiculous. And actually, its origins are eugenic, going back to the late 19th century. You can't rank intelligence, but we can rank information transfer rates. There's some really good theory around this. And what we can see is that Bowlby can transfer information only 300 times. You know, he's 300 times slower than us. But the point is, the machine is 300 million times faster. And the reason is because the machine is using electricity. Well, it's using electromagnetic radiation to communicate, which travels at the speed of light. Whereas we're using sound to communicate, and that travels at the speed of sound. And that's about a million times slower. So you get this natural reduction of a million. The reason it's 300 million is because of clever engineering around how computers communicate, which we don't exploit, which is interesting in itself. And in fact, we're silent a lot of the time. So we're not like constantly trying to use this bandwidth. And that difference is critical to our intelligence, because we don't feel it all the time. Of course, we all feel sometimes people don't understand us or they misunderstand us. But the reason we don't feel it all the time is because, you know, we've known no other state. We evolved like that. So we evolved in this state with this amazing brain, all this computational capability, or we evolved to have an amazing brain, but a very limited communication capability. And so much of human intelligence and human culture is how we overcome that limitation. And so much of what we find interesting about intelligence and culture is associated with that. And it's something that the machine just doesn't have, has never had. There would be no reason to put the machine in that state unless you were just trying to get it to behave more like a human. So it's a totally different form of intelligence. And the reason we forget it is because one of the ways we overcome our narrow bandwidth is we assume, as being mentioned before, that the entity we're communicating with thinks like us. Because if we assume it thinks like us, there's a bunch of stuff we don't need to communicate. We can leave that. I mean, I think it's Hemingway's, did he call it iceberg theory of writing? You only communicate the minimal amount because you can leave the rest to the reader and their experience. And I think that's the most beautiful thing in human communication, is it's effectively we're all doing some of that all the time. Or we're trying to communicate who we are. You know, a lot of our communication is actually about projecting an image of ourselves that we want others to believe in. And that's useful for others, because if they know we're a certain type of person, then they know how to communicate with us.
I love that essential metaphor of the diving bell on the one hand, the butterfly, the diving bell being the physical state, the butterfly being the imagination, the kind of reflective imagination. But I'm also thinking of the historian of Europe, Tony Judt, who was also locked in. And Tony Jutt wrote a book called The Memory Chalet. And his central image is his mind as a kind of physical storehouse, this memory chalet, because he loved going to the Swiss Alps as a child. And he remembers it. He structures his mind when he's locked in along the stations of the Lauberhorn Railway and going up to Wengen and to the Eiger. And the chalet is like part of this picture he has. But it's interesting that we reach for, as you say, like that idea of a well-stocked thing that we're trying to communicate.
Yeah.
But we can't, you know, show someone around the chalet that's inside of ourselves, but we can give a sense of what it's like to have a well-stocked mind.
Mm-hmm.
And that essential problem, I guess, yeah, illuminates part of our condition.
And that's Montaigne's phrase, of course, isn't it? The well-stocked mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it is a condition, but it's a beauty. It's one that leads to all this beauty, our culture, the cultural reference points we use.
And so what characterises that, Neil, is the difference. You seem to be saying that there's a profound difference between human intelligence and machine intelligence. And so the question is, what characterises both of them? And what are the advantages and disadvantages of those two forms of intelligence if, as you say, they are so different?
So if you get to the fundamentals, it's the use of information to take actions on the world, to first of all make predictions and then potentially take actions that intervene on the world. And if you look at it, roughly speaking, if you look at natural intelligences, the interactions on the world tend to ensure their persistence. Now, I like to disconnect that from the notion of intelligence. It seems to me perfectly possible that you could have an information processing entity that wasn't worried about its persistence. And of course, there's just not that many around because they weren't worried about their persistence. They just disappear. So the ones you tend to see, and there's a whole sort of chapter where I try and communicate and sort of re-talk about, of course, one could say, well, that's evolution. But I prefer to use different language around evolution in the book to try and capture this concept that it's about what you see is what has survived. And that means that when you look at intelligences that have been around, you know, in some form or another for millions of years, they tend to have certain properties which ensure survival. In fact, those properties tend to be primal. So there's a lot of our intelligence is dedicated to sort of, I keep using the sort of the Mike Tyson quotes, although I couldn't find the original source of it. Everyone has a plan till they get a punch in the mouth. And the primary point of our intelligence is to avoid punches in the mouth.
Yeah.
And
it's
very, very good at that. Whereas our machine intelligences are just not, because they've been designed and they've been designed with objectives in mind. And they haven't ever been exposed to the sort of complex environment that's around us. So these are two very different contexts, and you end up with two very different results, the fragility of machine intelligence.
Is that a physical, because of the physical context of human intelligence?
Yeah, it's the journey we've been on as organisms.
Mm, yeah.
And, you know, there's so much of what you see in that journey that's shared between us and other animals that isn't there in machines at all, like the ability to avoid the punch in the mouth. You know, I mentioned examples around, you know, swatting flies and how quickly they move away.
Mm-hmm.
I speak to my friends in neuroscience about that. I mean, it's always fascinated me. One of the joys of my field, because I started in this area in 1996, and it was such a diverse group of people, neuroscientists, cognitive scientists, you know, engineers, statisticians, physicists, all coming together to discuss these things that we knew were difficult to do with current technologies. So the early days of the field were very diverse. We were very lucky to sort of watch talks from world-leading neuroscientists about, you know, how a fly responds to an incoming hand. And the nature of those responses are also embedded in our brain. There are actions that we're taking. You know, our visual system is tightly connected with our motor system in ways that means, you know, like kids keep saying, oh, made you blink. You know, all this sort of stuff is like, yes, you triggered a fundamental mechanism that is important for the survival of my eyes. Thank you. And that's there layered in our intelligence in a way that we haven't had to put in machine intelligences because... you know, and I kind of use Butler a little bit to implicitly talk about this. Samuel Butler talks about how the machine enslaves us. And what he's really saying is, well, most of the time we automate something, we all have to run around the thing that's doing the automating because we're flexible and that entity isn't. And the idea that AI is different is what I call the great AI fallacy, because so far we don't see much evidence that it's different, that we finally got a technology that adapts to us, then we adapt to it. And I do think that's the most fundamental thing when people say AI. I think that's what they mean. Otherwise, it's hard to come up with a definition. But as I probe them about what they mean around AI, I think they mean a technology that sort of considers who they are and adapts to them and supports them, rather than most technologies, which we actually all have to learn how to adapt to. But I don't think we've built that. And I think one of the questions in the book is whether we are now building it. It's not clear to me.
Yeah, so that's not clear. I mean, is it possible?
I think the extraordinary breakthrough which we've had with generative AI is what in the book I refer to as a human analog machine, which is a very odd thing that we've created. It has all these concepts, these large language models, that are very human concepts. Like the examples I use in the book are terms around beauty or obscenity. These aren't terms we can define from first principles, but they're terms that as humans we all have a sense of. And it's Justice Potter Stewart that says, I can't define obscenity, but I know it when I see it. Mm. And this is sort of true of beauty and intelligence in, I think, most people's minds. Now, what's kind of interesting with generative AI, by getting computers to look at an enormous quantity of our data and forcing them to try and reconstruct our stories or our images, in order to do that well, they've had to reconstruct some of these concepts within the computer. So they've not been programmed to do that. In some cases, we can't even fully characterize how they're doing that. That's what people mean, oh, we can't understand it. I mean, I think that's a dangerous thing to say, but fully characterizing how they're doing that takes time and understanding. But we have, and I always try and be careful about the terminology, but the best way of saying it, we have given the computer a sense of these concepts that are very human. And that's caused everyone to, in effect, metaphorically run around screaming, don't panic, or we're all doomed. You know, it's sort of all become very Dad's Army, Corporal Jones and Private Fraser, because they see this machine as being able to talk to us, because that's the result. You can communicate in a chatbot way with
and
the machine.
And displacing us, presumably.
Yes, but the machine's always displaced us. But I think what's particularly interesting about this wave is that the people who are getting frightened are the professionals.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you have made your career by translating English into legalese and all of us, and you thought that was very clever and other people couldn't do it and you were making money that way, and now you're saying, oh, well, this machine's doing that pretty well as well. I mean, certainly to the level of probably a junior lawyer. You know, my experience in my field is it has a really good go at the first pass of it. It can't capture the nuances, but that even might come. Let's not assume that's not going to come. And that's sort of very personal to you. But I think if you go, like, I spent a lot of time working in Sheffield. My children grew up in Sheffield. And when we used to go and play football out east in the old coal mining areas, and you're looking at populations where we were playing football against miners' welfare clubs where there wasn't a mine, Staverley.
Yeah.
And that whole population has had everything taken away from them.
But that's a technological process that we've become used to, that idea of replacement technologies.
But I think what's interesting about that, and we're suffering the consequences of now with the sort of the rise of, the terms are too clumsy, aren't they? But the rise of populism, but the sort of dissatisfaction with our political processes is stemming from these communities that were ignored when that was happening and weren't allowed to participate in a process because it just seemed simple. The right answer is get rid of coal mines or whatever, which maybe it was. Mm-hmm. But how you go about that,
it's the engagement.
It's the engagement that counts, right? Yeah. And the difference, of course, with this wave is all the people who are most feeling how they're going to be affected are actually empowered.
Yeah.
There was, after Brexit, I was involved in Royal Society Working Group on Machine Learning, very important working group that really laid the foundations of current UK policy. And there's lots of sensible stuff. That and other things that happened. This is like 2016, just after the vote. And we were in a room with senior scientists, you know, MPs from the relevant select committee and various policymakers talking about machine learning futures. We were in such a good position in the UK at this time because we had such amazing people and we were very engaged with this through our professional societies, you know, through our national academies, I should say, with the Royal Society. And we just had the Brexit vote, and it had quite a dramatic effect on a lot of the things we were thinking about. And the moment where the most dramatic effect occurred to me is one of the MPs said, and it was a cross-party group of MPs, "I suspect no one in this room voted for Brexit." Mm. And I looked around and thought, I ended up saying, I suspect you're right, and isn't that the problem? Because here we're sat in a room of people making, we're sensible people making decisions about things which we're trusted by the nation. Mm. And the people who are upset are not actually in the room. Now, oddly with AI this time round, the people who are getting upset are in the room, but they're not responding with much maturity. And they're not responding in the way that they're supposed to as professionals, which is not to say, well, hold on a minute, I make all my money through performing these trivial things that other people can't do, translating English into legalese. Well, they're now trivial. They weren't trivial before. Mm. What the purpose of the profession is to protect individuals in society from their vulnerabilities to this system by standing up for them because you understand the law. And that side to professions is something that you can't replace with the machine. The other bit of translating language from one to another, it looks like we can do.
Well, one thing I thought about is that I expected the book to be fascinating and thought-provoking and stimulating. What I didn't expect it to be was moving. And I was particularly touched by when you refer to Eisenhower, Dwight D. Eisenhower, Commander-in-Chief at D-Day, who has to take decisions in real time that he knows will involve the deaths of thousands of young men on the 6th of June and beyond in 1944. And I think anyone who's read the diaries of Allenbrook, who was the British Commander-in-Chief at that time, will know the way that they thought through these processes. But they're processes that I presume can only be taken by humans. And so you've talked about how difficult it is for computers, for machine intelligence to deal with beauty. Could a machine ever have courage in the way that the kind of moral courage, that visceral courage that someone like Eisenhower has when he has to take these brutal decisions and has to confront the reality of these extreme conditions? And also, is there a danger with machine intelligence that politicians, and I think we already see this to a certain extent, of politicians relying on, say, now they rely on quangos, you think of something like the independence of the Bank of England, so that politicians no longer set interest rates, for example, that they will use artificial intelligence in order to say it's the machine taking the decision rather than the human being, as Eisenhower did and Allenbrook did, and therefore create the kind of ruptures between the commander-in-chief and the frontline soldier. And you can, you know, expand that in all kinds of ways, as you've just done with the relationship between politicians and communities. Mm. Is that a real danger then?
Yeah, I'm so pleased you brought all those things up because, I think it's a massive danger. And people who know me, I can be much more polemic in person than the book tries to be.
And it's very fair-minded.
The book really tries to be very fair-minded. But I'm really worried about this. And that's why I get more polemic in person, because I'm sort of angry about it as well. Mm. But the collection of ways the book tries to bring that across and the conclusion you're coming to, you're not telling me, Neil, it says in the book on page 320 that this is happening. The collusion you're coming to is the same one I come to. And the sense is, if I'm right about this, then I just have to lay out these stories and people will see the same thing, because I think it's exactly it. So I don't really talk about this in the book or use this term, but I think there's a sort of, I talk about this, perhaps not how I'm going to talk about it now. What a notion I think of as sort of social jeopardy. I don't think I use that phrase in the book, but it's a phrase I like. The point about Eisenhower is he exists within human society. Of course, he's a powerful man, mm-hmm. but with that power comes responsibilities that until recently, with recent political processes, we expected our politicians to conform to them, and there are institutions around them that hold them to account. And it's not direct holding to account in the way that it would be if we were in a group of indigenous people living together in a smaller community, like before we started urbanizing. But it's an evolved institutional way of holding things to account. And you can see it, and it is moving. You can see it in the responsibility that Eisenhower felt and in his writings and in his actions. And there are videos, which I mentioned, of him walking among the troops. And I think that those qualities in him was one of the major reasons he was chosen for leading that, because he wasn't a sort of fire and brimstone general. You think about the incredible complexity of his job, bringing a coalition of allies together around that is also extremely difficult.
And you get the sense that the people around him also had that same kind of moral courage, that same kind of moral clarity as well.
I think you're right. A machine can't have moral courage because it's not got social jeopardy in that sense, because it's not vulnerable. It's not human. It doesn't suffer from the potential loss of reputation, loss of life, loss of livelihood, loss of family.
And guilt.
One of the things that's interesting, and of course we lost this generation, and I try and bring this generation back a bit through tales of my own grandfather, because I just feel incredibly guilty that I just would listen. You know, we didn't. I used to listen to my tales of my granddad about the war, you know, as a sort of like thing that he would tell us when we were going to bed or whatever, or things that happened. But then there's that whole sort of thing that was going on in Only Fools and Horses about, oh, going on about the war, isn't there? But now we've lost that generation of people who felt this, lived it and saw it. There's almost a triviality to some of these decision makings that comes from the lack of experience. And it's very common when you read stories about people for them to be remembering what this could be their own children to go. And it doesn't actually mean you have to have children to imagine that. Mm-hmm. You can imagine those relationships as another human. I mean, we're all in this together. We have that sort of capability. And that's the other sort of slice that I say can't be sliced away. The first is that our intelligence is based on our limitations. So at the heart of the human is limitations. And the second is our vulnerabilities. And the fact that those vulnerabilities give us this sort of societal jeopardy and give us a stake in this society that, and I'm not an expert on this because I'm not a philosopher, but I'm inclined to believe that I don't think you can have agency without it, because your agency is sort of critically dependent within the wider society on that social jeopardy of some form. Now, it doesn't mean machines won't end up being involved in society, because you can already see that companies are an example of entities that don't have this social jeopardy.
Just to bring up my own grandfather, who actually died last year, so he's often on my mind. He worked in the paper industry, and he started off as an engineer and then went up through the company. But even when into his 90s, he could talk about the industrial processes at any point. He could say, this is how the technology moved in this XYZ way. He had a total respect for people with different skills because he knew them all. He'd gone from the bottom all the way to the top, and he had this very embodied intelligence that had been built up over years of actually encountering people who had skills that were different to his, maybe. That is kind of characteristic, I think, of some of those kind of post-war industrial captains of industry mentality. Fast forward to now, and you bring it up right at the end of the book, the Horizon scandal, the post office scandal, which seems to me a kind of perfect test case for some of the flaws of this new world that people are bringing to being.
And blaming technology.
Yeah, and blaming technology. Do you think it's because there isn't that embodied kind of experience plus automation? There's respect for what machines can do and what can give us, but you need that embodied intelligence as well.
Yeah, I think there's multiple things going on there. In society, the reason why we allow entities which don't make moral decisions, don't operate as humans, is because it allows us to scale, right? So that's why we allow corporations, things that we don't hold to account in the same way we would hold another human to account. Mm-hmm. But there are boundaries on which we decide where they can't go. But I think it is interesting, the point you're sort of making is related to a challenge we face, and I think British industry has faced it often and is facing it now again, right as we talk, that people who have this level of understanding are removed from the conversation when industry is moving forward. So when you look at the car industry and you look at the computer industry and aircraft, you see a great early start followed by utter catastrophic collapse. I mean, the reason it's a Fujitsu system in Horizon is it was initially ICL that Fujitsu bought, and ICL was the remnants of the British computer industry that is talked about in the book. And so there's sort of one level, there's that going on, that the failure to have people who actually understand processes and understand what's going on the ground at the higher management levels, and this is very characteristic of Britain, and we're doing it again. We've got a whole load of people now in charge of our AI policy that have limited to no understanding of the technology, and that's one of the reasons that I'm deeply worried, because you see that in the Horizon scandal as well, that But there's another facet to the Horizon scandal that I find even more worrying, that I try and communicate in the book, that I'm trying to describe, and I tried to make this argument too quickly across the weekend, so I'm a bit cautious about how I'm trying to make it now, because I think in the book it tries to show things rather than tell. But the broad argument is the following, that our professions emerged on the back of the inverted commas scribes, the people who controlled writing, and only a small section of society was able to write in most early civilizations until the invention of the printing press. Literacy was restricted. And the people who were literate, the scribes in different societies, and I just bumped into a Chinese colleague of mine, and he was explaining in China at one time it was the Buddhists that ran the sort of administration of the empire, and the empire worked very hard to pull that in so that it was the empire itself, the Chinese empire, not being run by the Buddhists. Of course, in Europe, it was the clergy that tended to control writing, but it was always something that was there, this group of people that controlled writing and therefore controlled the information infrastructure. Now, with that control came responsibilities. So, you know, I go back to Mesopotamia and things I learned from an amazing colleague in Cambridge, Jonathan Tenney, who I cycle with, and we ended up working together a bit and learned so much about Mesopotamian culture. And what you see in the tablets he looks at is that the early tablets, certainly, well, he's looking at later tablets, but most tablets are about administration, like movement of goods or legal judgments. And so what you have is our modern professions emerge from the scribes to gain responsibilities alongside their ability to control. So when we were talking about lawyers earlier, we're seeing them become afraid because it's like, well, now computers can do my control-y bit. But the other piece they have is this responsibility to look after people according to their vulnerabilities, the asymmetry of the legal system, that it's much more complex than any individual can understand. And I think what's stunning in the Horizon scandal is how all those individuals are undermined. I know there's lots of reasons we can talk about with the Horizon scandal, but to me, something that I think it's the Joe Holloway character in the dramatization at some point says something like, I can't understand whether they're evil or incompetent. And that's what you see when the professions in our society have lost power because they're no longer operating the information topography, as I call it, directly. So with books and written material, all these lawyers and accountants can interact directly with the production of information, the monitoring and the modification of information. And of course, the sub-postmasters before the introduction of Horizon were doing exactly that. They were doing their own bookkeeping. I don't know if it's as strong as accounting, but they were responsible for the accounting. They're doing their own bookkeeping. They were probably following systems like double entry bookkeeping that enabled them to be confident about what was going on in their business.
A technology that's hundreds of years old as well.
Yeah. And then you say, right, well, the machine's going to do all that for you. And you have no idea how that's working. And there are bugs introduced early on. And to be fair, this is the late 1990s, and it's a distributed system. So the way they decide to build it, which I think is sensible, is you have one person working on the point of sales thing, one person working on something central, and then you're sending messages. They're using early message passing, which is how all large-scale systems, like when I was at Amazon for 3 years, and that's how these systems work. But this was the first wave of doing this. And one of the things they failed to do was decide what a valid message looks like. And that's the first thing you have to do. You have to decide what valid messages are valid and which are invalid. And everyone has to work to that. If you don't do that, you can create a mess. And my understanding is they didn't do that. And what that means is downstream that when messages that aren't common, that you're not seeing them all the time, are being sent that aren't considered valid messages by one part, it's like two of us communicating and one of us saying something in gobbledygook, but the other one not receiving it and that not being captured. That was going on in the system. Those type of rarer messages, as I understand it, were the type of messages that were sent when you had a power cut and your system went down and had to come back online. This is called persistence within software engineering. And it's in any major system, you focus on this massively. When you come back online, how do you make sure you haven't missed anything? And how do you make sure that, you know, any of your records that you were sending don't need to be sent again? And basically, my understanding, I've read around the documents, I've not gone into detail or double checked, is that this wasn't happening. Now, what's so fascinating about all that is that to me, as a sort of not a deep expert in those software systems, but a technically capable person who's worked on large systems at Amazon for 3 years. I can see that and come to that conclusion, understand what's going on quite quickly. But none of the civil administrators, the accountants or the lawyers were empowered or enabled to. And in fact, there were effectively laws in place saying that you have to prove that the system's not working. It's going to be considered to be working until you prove otherwise. But none of them were given any access to the system. And the responsibility, we don't have the mechanisms of responsibility around the software engineers who built the system to hold them to account. So the power's all moving to the software engineers, what I think of as the modern scribes, and their guilds being big tech companies. But the responsibilities are still sitting with the lawyers, the accountants, the civil administrators. And even when you, I mean, it'd be interesting what the result of the inquiry is, but, you know, it's just quite depressing at times with just people pointing fingers at other parts of the system that had failed, but it's actually systematic failure. This, you know, my co-worker, Jess Montgomery, was actually clerk on the select committee where Alan Bates gives evidence. So I went and watched her. They never show the clerk, but she'd always told me about this. We work very closely together. She directs AI at CAM. And always been aware of it. And my mum had been. And we were always curious, why isn't this a bigger issue? So that's 2015, that select committee. And the issues are sort of seem to be already known at that point. But it's a systemic failure, I should say. And the systemic failure is originating in not very advanced computer technology. It's, you know, it's what would be done well today. But when it was built in the 1990s, they didn't build it well. And, you know, that's why I sort of feel we're now sowing the seeds of 10,000 horizon scandals, because we've got all the same pattern. We've got the people in who are making the decisions have no experience of large companies and large software systems. They have no experience of societal outcomes and what being at the coalface of what happens to people when you make these sort of interventions. They don't have theoretical experience of the methodologies. And they're being empowered through this ecosystem of Twitter, where their voices are loud and amplified, to dominate the debate. And of course the politicians, I'm very sympathetic to politicians, of course the politicians who have an enormous amount to do when they're trying to reach for something, they grab for someone who sounds confident about things and seems to know something. But actually, that type of confidence is the same type of confidence we see in ChatGPT. It's based on sort of, you know, bluster at large times and no experience of life.
How you're putting it, it's a bit like this idea of information topography. If you watch something like The Wire about the ecosystem of drugs in Baltimore, it's kind of the same problem. How do you solve a human problem? How do you solve eventually The Wire, that television program which expands all through the kind of economy of a broken society in Baltimore in the 90s and 2000s? It becomes a sort of problem of like, how do you solve Baltimore?
Yeah.
Like, how do you solve the thing that just is there? And there is no answer. There is just people grappling with a systematic problem over time.
That's right. And I think the problem is with everyone goes for solve. Mm. That's where the error is. There is no solution. Every time people think there's a solution and try and impose it, sort of genocide follows, right? Mm. There is just trying to make things better, trying to understand people's problems and trying to get better, because there is no, if there were one way of being, then all cultures would have converged on it. I mean, we've been around sort of doing stuff. That's the sort of persistence point. There is no one way of being. And there are tensions within society that need mechanisms to resolve. And the challenge we face when the information topography shifts, or when you look at the situation in US cities, which is related to information topographies, because it's about changing in ways of working, the, you know, urban flights and how communities move in, and those communities not having time to settle and not having time to understand how to interact with each other. And then you sort of get increases in crime. When you look at things that work, it's when people are allowed to settle and engage and understand different roles in society and sort of support each other. The problem is that takes time to establish. Mm. And every time we're getting towards some form of establishment of it, it's disrupted by like the introduction of, you know, the things they did in the United States where they put interstate highways, separating off communities, and in particular in poorer communities. And I've run around Baltimore, according to all my American colleagues, very foolishly, through all the areas that The Wire represents. And everyone's like, how are you even alive? Well, you're alive because it's not the way it is on TV, because people don't bother someone who's just jogging through the town. They will bother you if you're coming in, you know, I'm not advising. people do this. But that was the history of what my brother was dealing with as a lawyer. I mean, I tell a bit of his story in the book. And I learned so much from him and his stories going into those areas, trying to support the difficulties that people were facing, the people who are scapegoated by society for being responsible, when in actual fact, they're just responding to social changes, which they have no control over. And you can see we're all about to go down the same sort of route. And the real problem is because there isn't a solution, but there are better ways of operating where you listen to people and work with them and try to help them in solving their challenges. But that isn't the sort of thing that sounds good, you know, from the soapbox, is it?
And so we've come full circle there in a way when you talked about that Manichaean choice between the dystopian and perfection, which is always the worst path to follow. We've seen so many times over, you know, you talked about the deep historical path you follow in this book. But I mean, if there's one thing we can learn from humanity, the seeking of perfection usually ends up in hell. I think there's a great, you know, those who in Elysian fields would dwell, would expand the boundaries of hell. I think, you know, that's exactly it, what we're trying to do, rather than just dealing with the reality. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to sound negative, and I'm sure you don't want to do, but where do you see the positive aspects? How could AI be applied positively?
I see positive in people. I see positive in people everywhere. You know, it's often about how we're convened that brings out the more negative side for us. But whenever I get the chance to have an individual conversation, I mentioned one example in the book where I was visiting a colleague in the Natural History Museum who was running their AI department, and the security guard saw their title and went, "Oh, AI." And, you know, this happens a reasonable amount. And while waiting, and just had a conversation around these technologies and what they might mean, not telling him, but just, you know, he said, "Well, no one's going to have a job." And I said, "Oh, but Lionel Messi will have a job, won't he?" And then sort of going through that and what that means. Because the fundamental thing, so I don't, again, this isn't in the book, but I do some business stuff on the back of these ideas where they always, people complain about the book not having predictions. It doesn't have predictions because the predictions are supposed to be coming from people being empowered and their own ideas. They come from other people. But if I do say things, I say the future, I can tell you a few things that aren't going to happen. I don't always say what's going to happen, but here's something that I think will be the case, that the sort of bottleneck in this ecosystem, the sort of gold in the economy, or, you know, whatever the thing is that is we're all caring about most, because there's never going to be infinite of it, is human attention. So Tim O'Reilly, who I had the pleasure to spend some of last weekend with, and I didn't go too deeply into this, but he's written about the attention economy, the notion that actually the modern economy is about who is getting the human attention, and the way to do that is what? So this is thing number two. Well, what does TikTok do? You show humans other humans. We won't stop being fascinated by other humans. So it won't stop being the case that the limited supply thing is human attention. And then number two is it won't stop being the case that humans are fascinated by other humans. These two things will be there in 10 years, 20 years, 50 years. The third thing, though, is corporations who are, bring many, many, many benefits and do a lot of things at scale, they won't stop trying to corner the market. I mean, I can't even remember what the quote was relating to, but in the Financial Times this morning, I was reading Satya Nadal saying, "We want to capture AI or capture," you know, and it's, that's horrific. That's horrific. And I mean, one of the things that isn't being talked about is all the work that was done before the excitement in government that sort of led to the loss of expertise in certainly UK government, I think other governments have done a lot better in the sort of first wave of ChatGPT, is starting to bear fruit. And something that is really exciting, and we didn't see reported on at all in the election, and it's, I don't know even very good with the name, but the Digital Markets Competition and Consumers Act, which was passed, got royal assent on 24th of May, just before they all disappeared for the election. It was touch and go. It was touch and go. This is an act that has been long planned, that in the UK, because we've left the EU, our competition authority obviously has to grow. That competition authority has integrated in itself much better digital understanding, digital capabilities with the digital markets unit. And the powers that the Digital Markets Unit now has, as far as I'm aware, are the largest in the sort of liberal democracies to intervene, to try and deal with the challenge of these digital markets, the challenge of these information topographies. If you look at the values of these top big tech companies, all these values have these growth estimates that imply that they're going to be dominating the information ecosystem for the future. Now, if this technology is going to deliver even 20% of the promise that even reasonable people are sort of saying about it, it has to bring back the control of the information topography to individuals. Mm-hmm. It has to do what the printing press does. And, and it's even more urgent because at least like when the printing press existed, you had a secure ecosystem. It wasn't the case. I mean, the clergy were undermined over time and power shifted over time. But we're already in a position before this technology's emerged, going back to Horizon, when the ability of key institutions in our society to do their roles in what Karl Popper calls the open society has been undermined. And this technology offers us the opportunity to go back. So I see extraordinary potential in individual people, not the ones on Twitter necessarily. I mean, they're probably nice when you meet them individually, but what they write on Twitter isn't very helpful. But when you have a conversation, and I see enormous possibilities, tremendous possibilities in terms of bringing the decision-making, the co-creation back to where it belongs, which is to those people, through these new information technologies that in the first case have undermined society. And what we need to do is start making the decisions to ensure that they are leading to a more prosperous, flourishing society, which puts our citizens back at the heart of it, rather than our views of what information technology is.
I have heard it described by historians that a lot of new technology was enabling the reversal of the printing revolution, or the gains of the printing revolution and the Protestant Reformation, to be Weberian there. You're suggesting that that may not be the case, that may be able to reverse that process in some way, or at least have a new, enlightened version of it.
Well, my favourite book on this is Julia Lepore, on These Truths, which covers the history of the United States, but therefore covers these information revolutions. Yeah. And you get a sense, and of course it's 200 years after the printing press. I mean, we're only getting to that when it starts, but it gives you this sort of sense that it wasn't one way back then, that there's a cartoon picture of it.
Yeah. It's not wiggish. Yeah,
yeah. And the tensions are, there's these interesting tensions between small C conservatism and small L liberalism, and that they're constantly sort of playing out as you develop these technologies.
And fertilizing one another.
Fertilizing one another, and different approaches are needed in different domains. But then for me, then that's why the sort of Popper's notion of open society and piecemeal social engineers and how you deal with these transformations becomes so key, that you want to distribute it amongst those that are capable. And yes, I think that that's where my optimism is, that we can get back to a sort of, I mean, not by the AI deciding things, but by reimagining some of our institutions. For example, education changes dramatically in the face of this. And you can already see that process going on. We worked closely with the Department for Education at a group I was co-chairing with Susan Alcland-Hood to put out early advice for what teachers should do in this face of technology. She did it, but it was informed by or her department did it, work we did together. And the Department for Education, and I'm not ignoring the politics of it, just looking at the way, and actually though Diana Baron, who was the minister responsible under the last government, she was extraordinary, just extraordinary in terms of her interest in talking to the right people and doing the right things for teachers. And you can sort of ignore the politics. There were people like Diana, or I should say Baroness Baron, out there in all these domains. And we just need to make sure that we aren't holding them back, because in the end, that type of work stands on its own merits, and the silly things fall on their lack of merit, as long as the ecosystem is able to truly see what's going on.
Well, let's end on that positive note, Neil. We've covered an awful lot of ground, and thank you very much, but it is Partey Hemingway, just the tip of the iceberg, I think, and I can't recommend your book enough. It's published by Alan Lane. Its title is The Atomic Human, Understanding Ourselves in the Age of the AI. And I hope we've given you a substantial flavour of that, but we highly recommend it. So thank you, Neil. It's been a real pleasure and a very stimulating one.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks, Alistair. It's been a great pleasure to talk to you both.